Okay, so yeah, so I thought I would start by just putting up what a subset of what Muizin put up yesterday, and I think that this is a really nice map for our discussion today. So we had this idea of if you have a memory that can be trained, you have to choose how you're going to put that memory in the system. You know, you start with a system that can retain memory, and we'll talk about what that means. And you know, you make several decisions, and then you have to make some decisions about the readout, and then hopefully you'll be able to retrieve that information. And what we talked about yesterday was really I guess I should say this covers a large fraction of the memory behaviors that are of interest to us, but there are also memories that are of interest to us that Muizin mentioned that we're not sure how to fit in this. This framework. Oh, is there a problem? Oh. It is muted? Okay.
Let me double check.
To me, those look like memories that are not trained or that are very hard to train, but relatively straightforward to design. And so the self-assembly stuff that Zarana does and origami, right? These are things that I don't know if they're straightforward to design, but they're certainly better when designed than if you try to train them. And also memories that are evolved. We haven't really talked about biological evolution, the evolutionary processes as a form of training. Muizin also mentioned machine learning. The thing about the designed memories and the machine learning memories is they seem much more associative than any sort of programming or message sending or something like that. But that's okay. So I just want to put an asterisk on these because we might want to come back to them later. And they deserve a mention. Okay, so what we covered really yesterday, what Muizin led us to is cyclic training to an asymptotic steady state. Then you apply a single amplitude to a copy of the system, and you look at how much it changed after application of that amplitude, and that's how you read out the memory. And the forcing we kind of left as a, that could be generic, and then we left out the discussion of noise. And so that leads me to, oh, and then we talked about point reversibility, loop reversibility, and this sort of intermediate sequence of states. And the question that we, I thought, did a pretty good job addressing was, why is it so easy to find limit cycles? Or at least, why is it so easy to find, for many systems, some parts of parameter space where you can get limit cycles, you can expect them? Okay, so that's sort of a recap, and I kind of want to pick up where we left off. And I have a few key questions, and Leticia is going to really, I think, help us to think about the first one. Is that, are there a few key features of dynamics that lead to interesting memory? Not necessary, not sufficient, but just important, right? Things that stand out and are notable. And one thing that I really want us to think about is if there are some types of memory that are somehow inextricably linked to systems with depending physics. And then I think we can also have a really good discussion about friction. And then if we have time, we should talk about the opposite. We should talk about unlearning, erasure, retraining, noise, that sort of thing, and multiple memories. Okay. So with that, I want to turn it over to Leticia. And I think Leticia had some things in mind after yesterday about spin glasses that I think could help us further this discussion, so.
Thank you.
Should you get the microphone?
Oh, yes, thank you.
What makes it possible to do multiple things?
Okay, so I thought it would be useful to recall all results from Spengler's experiments and theory, but something a little bit discussed by Enzo Marinari at the beginning of the workshop, but of course many of you were not here when he talked, and he didn't spend a lot of time discussing them either. So, you know, it's not exactly the same setting as the one that you were interested in and your experiments, but I think it's similar, and I think there are similarities that can be perhaps exploited to understand your cases as well. So what I want to do is just show you one experiment and discuss it in different, discuss its main features of observations, and then two ways of giving some theoretical explanation for it that are more or less analytic, as you will see. Okay, so what is the experiment? So the experiment is just taking an insulating spin glass sample, taking it below its critical temperature, and so the control parameter is temperature here, so there's noise, and temperature is the knob that the experimentalist has to change the conditions under which the system evolves. And what they measure is the out-of-phase susceptibility. So this is just typical, observable in spin glass experiments. And what they do is they measure this out-of-phase susceptibility as a given frequency, as a function of time. And the temperature protocol that they apply in this case is one in which, say that TC is somewhere here, very quickly, I think you don't need, okay.
No, we can't see
we
it.
We can't see
oh,
it.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. Let me do it on the other.
Yeah, now we can see it.
So they quench very quickly to some temperature T. They keep this temperature T fixed until some time, say T1. Then they go to T minus delta T, and then they go back to T. So this is, say, T2, and this is time. So this is the protocol. And they measure this out-of-phase susceptibility all along the evolution in time. So the first thing that you see is that this susceptibility is not stationary. It depends on time. So this is the aging effect, the fact that the system is evolving, and you can characterize it better with other kinds of measurements, but just say that since it's evolving in time, the system is not stationary, it's evolving, it's aging. Next thing that you observe is that when you lower the temperature suddenly, the relaxation restarts in the sense that there is a peak here, and then you know the susceptibility decays in a different manner. It also depends on time, so it also ages. But there is this rejuvenation phenomenon that it's linked to this restarting of the relaxation. And if you were to compare this form to the one that you would have found by, oops, sorry, I have a very short time, that you would have found by quenching instantaneously the sample to this second temperature here, at this time, say, you could have more or less obtained the same curve here. So there is like a complete reinitialization of the relaxation of the problem that occurs at this time at which you change the temperature. So this is the full rejuvenation observed for this set of parameters. Of course, you know, I'm discussing the ideal case. So if the delta T were not so large as the one that they considered here, everything would be a little bit more fuzzy. But you know, in the ideal case, there is full rejuvenation after this change in temperature.
So the inset is kind of, you just edited out the interval in the middle and just joined the two.
I didn't get here yet.
Oh, sorry,
I'm
okay,
just talking
I'm
about
here.
This part here.
Yeah, okay,
so it's important to have in mind that there is this rejuvenation phenomenon appearing by the going down in temperature. And then you go back, and then what you say occurs. So there is a going back to the relaxation that you had at the initial temperature T. And if you erased this intermediate interval here, you put the two curves together, and it looks like you just had the relaxation that you would have had at temperature T from the instantaneous quench at the initial time. So this time is irrelevant. It's like erased.
Can I just clarify, what do you imagine that there's a, when you drop the temperature to 10K, the susceptibility increases,
right?
And you hope that in the ideal world it would be all the way up to 7 or something.
is that, I mean, it's not that high, but one hopes that that's the case.
I've never really
understood why that should be in this case.
Okay, I will give a possible explanation of what's going on there later. Okay, in the short presentation. I mean, it's not understood in full detail, but there are two ways of giving an explanation for this. One is more mean fieldy, so it's more, landscape sort of explanation. The other way, it's more real space. So yeah, the thing which is strange is that there is this realization, and then, however, there is memory kept. So this is kind of, how could this be? So let's try to give a simple, I don't know if it's so simple, but some explanation of what's going on. The mean field explanation uses the free energy landscape kind of reasoning. So what I'm sketching here, you have to think that it's part of a branch in the Ginsburg-Landau-like free energy landscape below TC. So, okay, this looks complicated, but you are all used to the free energy landscape of a ferromagnet in the Ginsburg-Landau description, so it's just below TC. It's a double web, right? And, there is some other parameter here, which is very clear in the case of the ferromagnet, but it's not so clear here, but there is a space of other parameters in this case, and some free energy landscape. Because of inversion under spin reversal, changing the sign of all the spins, you have this symmetry here. You also have a symmetry of this kind in the spin class problem. I'm going to consider just, one part of it. So I eliminate this spin reversal. And it turns out that the free energy landscape of the mean field spin glass model, which is the Sherrington-Kilpatrick model, has this tree-like structure, which is much more complicated than this one, and that it changes with temperature. So in this case, if you change temperature, the free energy landscape will change a little bit, but the fact that you have these two minima will not change, right, below TC. The height of this minimum on the width, the width may change with temperature, but there is one. While here, there is not one. When you change temperature, there is this branching phenomenon. And it's like, it's not completely perfect what I want to say, but it's a bit like there being a series sequence of phase transitions. In this case, when you open up these two minima from the one at high temperature, this occurs at the phase transition. Here it's like at each infinitesimal temperature that you're lowering, you're opening up new minima, and it's like going through phase transitions in sequence.
So why is the temperature opening up new minima instead of the temperature allowing you to explore already existing minima?
So that's a different question. So
okay.
This is statics. So I'm looking at the free energy landscape. The free energy as a function of the other parameter is a function of the other parameter and temperature. Right, so this is the other parameter in the ferromagnetic case. And temperature, what we'll do is that we'll change this form. But for the ferromagnetic case, it changes it in a trivial way. And here, it changes it in a non-trivial way. Then when I will do dynamics, temperature will help me
explore.
But for the moment, it's just a static thing. I'm not moving.
So it's playing two roles.
It's playing two roles. So like here, when you talk about temperature here, you can say that you use temperature to explore the free energy landscape of just say that it allows you to have two minima when at high temperature you had only one.
That's a question. You use the word free energy landscape.
Yes.
And of course, there is no such thing as the free energy landscape. So you mentioned that there are order parameters.
Yes.
But the landscape could look very different if you have different order parameters. So doesn't this whole thing imply a choice of your order parameters?
Well, in the case of the mean field spin glass problem, the other parameters that you have to use are quite clear. I mean, they are the local magnetizations of your problem. So this is why I said there is not only one. In the ferromagnetic problem, you have the magnetization density or local magnetization density will be magnetization value will be the same. In the spin glass problem, they are not the same. So what you have to use are these MIs, and then here, this is a high dimensional substrate that you have to use in that.
So it is high dimensional, but it doesn't have the full dimensionality of the original problem because then it would be an energy landscape.
Exactly. So these MIs, there are n of them. So there is one for each spin. So it's an n-dimensional substrate that you have here. It's not 2 to the n. It's
so I wanted to send to this. We don't want to spend too much time on the very interesting problems that this presents, but rather we want to
They're important questions anyway. So okay, so this is the static solution. It's exact, can be constructed, no doubt about that, for the mean field problem. And this is just one branch. You have to think that this comes from higher temperature. TC will be somewhere above, and you will have this in the full low temperature. So now, in principle, you're not allowed to use these free energy landscapes to say, well, now I'm going to do dynamics and start thinking about jumps over the bars and things like that. It's not so obvious that you can do that. But okay, let's accept you can. So the people in Saclay, the experimentalists, were using this picture in the late 80s, 90s, early 90s, to think in terms of dynamics. Okay. So now, first of all, let's try to think at what happens when you do an instantaneous quench to a temperature T. So it's like saying, okay, I'm going to be at this level, let's say, of the landscape. Now, in time, what will happen is that, say that your initial state, I'm being a little bit imprecise, but okay, let's say that the initial state falls here. So it will have some time to explore this minimum. Then it will need some time to go and, explore these two, and then so on, and then so on and so forth. So the existence of all these different minima with barriers, which actually don't scale very rapidly with n. This is known. The barriers scale with, I don't know where I wrote it, somewhere. They are lower than n, but there are many of them anyhow. So the existence of all these minima implies existence of many time scales in the problem from this phenomenological picture. Now, from the exact solution of the dynamics, this can be proven. So the fact that you have many time scales and a hierarchy of time scales needed to relax the initial states of the system, this can be proven analytically. Now, how can you use this tree to understand or say something about delta T protocols? Now, this experiment here. So imagine that after quenching to temperature T and leaving the system some time to relax, the system has, relaxed around here. Now you change temperature and you decrease temperature. So the landscape changed. So the system say that it was happy within this minimum. When you put it down here, it has to reaccommodate to this internal structure. It needs some time to do that. And it needs to rejuvenate and have a new dynamics that corresponds to the relaxation within this structure here. But when you come back in temperature, you come back to the same place where you started from. And there is a memory of where you came from. So in these simple terms, this can be made a bit more precise, but you have an idea of where is the rejuvenation coming from and where is the memory also coming from. Now, can this be more precise in terms of calculations, in terms of doing the dynamics of this model, of the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model? Well, this can be done. And everything comes, in the end, to this property of what we call weak long-term memory, high school effect. Okay, I can tell you why we call it this way. It's not important. So the point is that when you look at the evolution of these problems, the instantaneous response, it is the linear response that controls everything. The instantaneous response vanishes. But the integrated instantaneous response over a long period of time is finite. So the system has memory of what happened to it before through what happens to this linear response. Now, in the solution to the dynamics, the important thing is how this integrated linear response compares to the correlation function. So from the solution, it turns out that there is a relation between the linear response and the correlation function that you can plot in this way. And okay, I can give you more details about how this, why this form appeared. But for these models, the important thing is that in this relation between linear response and correlation, there are two regimes. actually, there is one regime that is completely controlled by the temperature of the bath, and which is not going to be so important in what I'm going to say, and another regime that corresponds to non-equilibrium relaxation that tells you about, you know, how to move between these minima, let's say. Now, when you are at a high temperature, so at the initial temperature of the quench here, this relation between linear response and correlation follows this line first, this straight line here, and then there is a curve. When you change the temperature to the lower temperature, the relation in the solution follows this straight line here and this other curve. So this part is the same, this part is different. This part opened up when you went down to temperature. These are the new relaxations that have to occur to accommodate to this internal structure here when you went down in temperature. And when you go back in temperature, up in temperature, you are coming again from here to here, and you erase these.
So sorry, are these new relaxations associated with new timescales as well?
Exactly. So there are new timescales that are needed to relax
okay. New
degrees of freedom, let's put it this way.
So you told us that once I quenched, there's two little subminimum that opened up.
Yes.
And it has to rearrange within those.
Yes.
But then you said, I see. Then you said, when it has to do that, it has to get a bigger susceptibility.
Yeah. Cool. This is observed, no? There is like
it's
a
observed,
new...
but the minimum picture implies that, you're saying.
Yeah, I'm saying, yes, exactly, because it has to...
It has to
relax.
It's easier to perturb. Chi means going up means it's easier to perturb when I'm drawing a little field.
If you wish, yes. Yes.
And why did that have to happen? Just because you had two subminima.
Oh, because you have a new structure to... It's like a new quench that you're doing. So forget about the... In this picture here, forget about all the rest of the...
Yes, I do. Right. Just look at that one.
So you look at this one. So it's like doing a new quench from this temperature to another temperature. And since this landscape is so complex, the new temperature below has a lot of structure to relax to.
So it has to do the same thing.
It has to do like the same thing.
Situation.
Exactly.
So
it's like
is it fair to say that, I mean, basically you're looking at susceptibility and that's kind of a slope in there, and now you have new maxima so that you're looking
It's like doing a quench from high temperatures. It's like doing a new quench from, across the critical temperature. Since I was arguing that at each temperature you have like a new phase transition between inverted commas. So when I go from here, it's like going from high temperature to low temperature. So I reinitialize my dynamics in this sense. You see, it's like...
Okay.
It's not exactly the same, but think in terms of the ferromagnetic problem.
Yeah.
When I'm in this branch of the tree here, I'm at like at high temperature, above the critical temperature. And then when I go down, I go to a different state of my problem. I go to the ferromagnetic phase, and then I have to relax, and then I have a sensitivity which is non-trivial. Here is approximately the same with Torino. I'm going from a situation that it's like above the critical temperature to one which is like below the critical temperature, but this all happens within the low temperature phase.
So we should.
Okay. So all these, what happens? I said it already. So there is, by going here, you open up these new relaxation channels, and then you have rejuvenation. When coming back, since this didn't change, which is a property of this model, it's non-trivial as well, you recover the memory that you have. Now, all this is done within this free energy landscape picture. Is mean fieldy because I took it from the solution of mean field problems. Can I do something similar in real space? And the way to do it is that you have to translate fast relaxation channels, the ones which are to the right of this plot, into short length scales. So imagine that in your problem, like in the ferromagnet, you have some domain walls, let's say, just to put it simply, that have to reconform according to, you know, what you do to the system. So fast degrees of freedoms are short length scales. Conversely, slow degrees of freedom are long length scales, and fast is here, faster is here, slower is here. All these are slow, but these are faster than those. Now, again, in terms of domain walls, a way to argue on, you know, do some phenomenological arguments and so on, is to think in terms of elastic lines in random potentials. You need some randomness to make the thing don't decay so quickly and make system have some slow dynamics. And the idea is that, okay, when you are at some temperature T, your line conforms to some arrangements that have some typical length scale that depends on temperature in a non-trivial manner. And the rejuvenation going at lower temperatures means that the shorter length scales have to reaccommodate to something else compared to what they had here. So this is the picture. Say this is structure at T, which is the dotted line here. It's not the good one at T minus delta T. And at T minus delta T, you have to generate some, you know, smaller length rearrangements that are the ones of T minus delta T. Then when you come back, since you kept some memory of the long length structure, you go back to what you had before. And then you have the memory. So this is a way of seeing in real space what's going on here. Okay, I use this experiment because it's simpler than this one to discuss, but you know, this is just a sequence of going down in temperature, waiting longer here, then you recover the memory that you have with the 1D experiment. You can analyze it with the same arguments that I used, and you will get the same conclusions that I told you, and you can get this memory as well. Now, of course, you don't have temperature as a control parameter, you have the shear and rate, but possibly arguments of this kind could be used to, you know, discuss what you have in your experiments as well. So the idea that you have to have a hierarchy of timescales related to land scales, maybe related to free energy landscape, but free energy landscape, we don't really need them. It's just a way of understanding things. And,
not if I write those on the board, just
oh, yeah.
As we get started with this. Okay, so you said,
is there any understanding of why it's so sharp for, I think, spin, but much broader for Heisenberg spin?
Actually, when you do the simulations, I have the transparencies below. The people who have done simulations, they see it more clearly in Heisenberg than in Ising. And there are arguments for that because when you start arguing about length scales in these problems, that can be measured in some abstract way, the temperature dependence in the Heisenberg ones are stronger than the ones in the Ising, and then it works better. So you know, I have the pictures here. I can show you. This is for Ising. The way in which these people plot the data is not very nice, but this is temperature T. Then they go down, and then they go back. You don't have the rejuvenation here. And so this is what is missing in this case. While if you do Heisenberg, this is what they got. So you get the rejuvenation. It's not full rejuvenation in the sense that this short dashed line is the one that you would have had with an instantaneous quench at this time to the lower temperature. So you see it's different. But apart from that, okay, they explain it and they discuss it. And you have some rejuvenation here, and you have memory as well in the Heisenberg more than in the. Yeah.
Thanks. This gives us a lot to work with.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I think we should try to. This is kind of the first question I want to talk about is, are there...
You should get the microphone.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, sorry.
And can we blank this, or do we have to turn it off? I'll blank it with my computer. Do you mind if I take
it back? No, it's over there.
Oh, it's yours.
It's
yours.
Okay.
Cool. Thank you.
them on. So, right, I want to ask this perverse question of, are there key features that seem to stand out in multiple systems that have interesting memory behaviors? And I grabbed two from Leticia's presentation of that this hierarchy of length scales and hierarchy of time scales could be important, but so maybe we could start with those. Like, this also showed up in, this behavior also showed up in the model that Yuof presented of crumpled sheets, right, where you had this spectrum of relaxation processes, and some were very slow. Most were very slow, and there were also some fast ones. Mm-hmm. And it also had, this also showed up in the shared suspension experiment. And I think you were right to think about that, because in the shared suspension experiment, you have some regions that are overdense, and these particles need to move apart, but they can only do it at the edges, right? And so you have a small overdense region here that relaxes very quickly, and you have a much larger overdense region here that takes more time. And so that was our thinking of how you could get a spectrum of time scales in that experiment.
I hate to be a wet blanket, but we, inspired by those very spin glass experiments that Leticia showed, we performed the very same protocol on what should be a very similar behaving system, at least to my limited understanding. That is to say, we performed the exact same protocol on Leonard Jones glasses. Mm. We took the two standard models of Leonard Jones glasses, the Cobb Anderson and the Langstrom model, and we performed precisely the same protocol.
Of aging and rejuvenation, you mean?
Yeah, so we did the protocol that's shown over there.
You called it?
Yeah, the exact protocol that Leticia drew up over there. The results were a disaster. Okay, I can show the graph if you like, or I can tell you. But the reason that the results are a disaster in the Leonard Jones glasses is that the aging occurs at the same rate at different temperatures. And that means that you don't get the memory effect, because you drop it to the low temperature and it's still aging at the same rate as if it were at the high temperature. So you don't get this.
I mean, yeah, I don't think that's a wet blanket. I think that's a really.
I thought it was described. I think the referee was pretty disappointed as well. But
this thing, it says the things that we determine whether a thing relaxation is slower to pass is not related to the temperature, but it is related to something, and maybe it's related to what he's about to say, or we just said.
I think it's related in our case, it's that we didn't get that deep in the energy landscape.
Well,
that is, I think if you get deep pressure.
Again, from Minfield expectations, this was expected, because, it's more like PSPN than like Sharenton Fitzpatrick models, and the pre-energy landscape that could be associated to Leonard Jones systems is different from the one that I showed.
Has this been done for PSPN models at this
Numerically even or analytically?
Yeah.
But the argument that I showed wouldn't work.
Wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work because this curved path in the KI2C is not the same, and it changes the temperature and it's the two. So you don't have this hierarchy of many different timescales, you have one, as you said, which is the same for all temperatures.
Right, so I think when
you don't have this kind of hierarchy in those programs.
When you have just one time scale to work with, I mean, you still have something that depends on its history, but it doesn't have this rejuvenation. It doesn't have a memory of, it doesn't keep a memory of recent things separate from a memory of older things.
Well, the crucial point is that it ages at the same rate.
Right.
Right.
So it stores its memory of recent things in the same way that it stores its memory of old things. And so when you go to recover the old things, the recent things have mucks them up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, and I think that is, you know, I mentioned that multiple memories is a question we might get to, but I think that's important also for multiple memories, that you have, you know, you don't want it, if you're trying to put in multiple memories by putting in a sequence of inputs or temperatures or whatever, you don't want it to just remember the last thing you did. You want it to remember two or three things ago.
So to get multiple memories, then, do you need to have a triple hierarchy of time scales, that there's fast, slow, and super slow?
Spectrum. Yeah, I mean, the idea is that, right, I think if you just have fast or slow, fast and slow,
that's not enough.
If you have sort of a bimodal distribution, that's probably not enough, right? You probably need some sort of continuous.
Well, but also a continuous thing, how finely can it be broken up? I mean, when we say separation of time scales, we say, you know, you're separated by more than order of magnitude or something, and that allows us to get, you know, two behaviors in general. But if you need three memories, then you need to have three different time scales that are well separated.
I mean,
Oh, so you're saying, can you like enumerate what is the minimum?
What is the minimum separation between
ranges
of time scales?
So if I
is it an order of magnitude that you need? If so, then, you know, training more memories becomes, every time you want a new memory, you need to have another order of magnitude of time scale.
Well, I mean, the one thing I guess I would have thought is that it's a question of how easy it is to see. That is, a lot of these things would be there, even, you know, it's just that you have to average up the gazoo to be able to get it. And so what I was just going to say was that you've listed a few of these things, spin glass, crumpled sheet, shear suspension, but then there's also this model that we have of the sorting, number sorting,
mm-hmm.
which has is really the same features. But in order to see it, we'd have to just average.
And every time you want to add, it gets exponentially longer that you have to wait. And so, while you could be able to do it, it could get painful, more and more painful.
Doesn't it depend on the aging dynamics? I mean, if the aging dynamics are sort of
logarithmic,
then it's the current size. But if they're more rapid, then maybe it's
easier. If they're logarithmic, then you get your spectrum for free, almost.
One.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that if it's so logarithmic in the sense that the the quantity in question changes with log time, linear with log time, and that way, yes, it's what Karen says, that you have to wait a really long time before you can do anything useful. But if it were to change more quickly, then maybe you don't have to wait as long. But most things that I've encountered are log error and log time.
Right. So you have to be patient.
So that would suck.
Yeah.
Yes. But, I mean, it doesn't, it's not clear that it has to be like that.
That is our question. So, I mean, about the distinction between what Paddy looked at and these spin glass models.
Right.
Like, I guess the mean feeling expectation comes from the picture that when you quench to low temperatures, the system will get stuck in one glass stage,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. That's the end of the story, right?
For the P-spin light.
For the P-spin light.
Right, because the P-spin models have, right. Say that you put it in a metastable state, but these metastable states don't have this internal structure that the SK has. And on top of that, from one to the other, you have barriers that are other n. So you will not go to the other one. While the Sherrington Kilpatrick has this particular feature of having relatively low barriers, n to some power but smaller than one, and this internal structure, you know, that reproduces itself. So this hierarchy within.
So, but going from the mean field picture to sort of a real class, there must be changes to this story, right?
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, when I said I was showing you the ideal case, when these people do delta temperature jumps, which are smaller than 2 degrees, let's say, everything gets more mixed up. The dynamics at the lower temperature influences the dynamics, so memory is not perfect, and then you have some effective time to put in the middle, and you know, the rejuvenation is not so strong.
Yeah, well, the reason I mentioned this is at least not in thermal aging, but in the sort of the driven glasses that we have been looking at.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very key feature that the system does, in fact, have on to go through different sort of gases, if you will, of different energies.
Right.
Which I guess correspond to these mean field glasses in the peaceful kind of scenario.
Right.
But the ability to make those transitions is sort of an important part of the picture.
Right.
To try to understand what's going on, which is not there in the mean field analysis.
Mm-hmm.
But is there some attempt, has there been some attempt to sort of see how one might build that additional feature in? To accommodate short range.
But I mean, something else I couldn't have said is that concerning Paddy's comment and yours, is that, you know, with the new ideas of the Gardner transition and so on, the phase that you have below the Gardner temperature is like the Shannon-Kilpatrick one.
Right.
So then, if you were able to, you know, if your system were in that region, then you would have something like this.
Yeah.
But of course,
but to be aware,
can be very difficult to get there.
The Gardner transition doesn't happen in soft potentials.
Okay.
Like that,
so,
I'm not sure that's particularly relevant.
So I mean, but it's really good to have counterexamples, right, for all these things. Sid, I maybe forgot when you said number sorting. Should that be on this list?
Well, it's a different kind of thing. It's just I thought it was the simplest thing that would show this kind of, that we could do in a simulation, but I didn't know that. I thought they couldn't do it in a simulation.
The deep experiments and so on. The deep experiments are
okay.
This one is simpler to see.
I said okay. So this was able to see the
difference. Because the deep experiment.
Actually, he called it thermal sort.
Yeah. Thermal sort. You're right.
Thermal
sort. Yeah.
Thermal sort. So we have the technical term.
Okay, so the other thing before we turn to friction, which I want to leave some time for, I thought I'm really curious what you think. I want to spend a few minutes talking about depinning, which is maybe also a term that can be stretched like memory is to cover a multitude of systems. But certainly, we see depinning-like features in amorphous solids in terms of how they yield plastically. So certainly, depinning-like ideas apply in charge density wave conductors, which is something that we know has an interesting multiple memory behavior. It seems like there are depinning-like features in spin glasses, although I don't know. I mean, you're maybe not activating depinning when you do these experiments, but if you apply a field or something, is that fair to say? There is.
Sure. How about Barkhausen noise?
Sure, I think, yeah, like ferromagnetic systems, let's say, certainly.
Okay. Yeah.
And aspects of spin glasses are ferromagnetic.
And you include the granular and the amorphous solids.
Ooh, good. Well, not and granular, but including
granular.
Yeah, including
granular,
yeah. Ferromagnetic and right, Barkhausen noise, especially. Where the memory itself is read out as depinning events. And so I was wondering if there are any others. And then I also wanted to think, is there some sort of inextricable or deep connection between memory in these systems and the fact that they have depinning physics and a depinning transition, right, if you drive them hard enough?
Whereas every time you get the depinning, it sort of wipes the slate clean and you have to start over.
Right, so that's a really good point. Depinning itself.
So this might be involved in the erasure, that when you get a big enough avalanche, you have a clean slate.
Depinning itself is correlated with erasure, basically, although not so much in charge density waves.
No, it is.
Well, why not?
It is.
Right?
I mean, because once you see, at least in the models for these charge density wave systems, the kind of depend or sliding state is somewhat a unique, is thought to be somewhat a unique state. In a sense that, you know, if you started the system in a pin state and you drove it into a depinning state, you're basically in one of the vanilla states that you have to be, which lost all the information of how it got there. If the depin state was a unique state, for example, that the moment you are, you know, at the given force, okay, the moment you enter the state, you basically, you know, that's the state that is there no matter how you got there. So you basically lost your history. Or if it was a few unique states, it would still be a memory loss mechanism.
So he's thinking of depinning so that it no longer is pinned at all.
It's right. So, so like ultimately,
there are
some
I think versions of that, which I think you're more thinking of. You push it a little bit and it glitches until it gets pinned again.
So
there are two parts. The sort of, you know, there is a depinning threshold beyond which hell breaks loose. Which is kind of similar to the sort of, you know, jamming transition or these other transitions that we've seen in these models, right? Where beyond a certain kind of shear, it's something, you
it's
know,
ergodic.
Chaotic. It's erratic, right?
Ergodic,
yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So for that kind of transition, there is erasure, I think, we agree, right?
Okay.
Because there's something, you know, there's a new dynamics that set in that basically quickly forgets, you know, what it did before it got into that ergodic state. On the other hand, this was something that, you know, talking with Karens and others after yesterday, what became clear to me is, yes, I mean, at least in the depending transition, if you are below that ergodic or depend state, then depending on how much you've kind of driven the system towards that depending state, you're building up correlations. You know, and sort of the idea is that once you're approaching this depinning state, the correlations become sort of as big as your system size. Okay. Now, in some sense, this kind of explains the asymmetry in this response to you trained it at a certain amplitude gamma, you reduce the amplitude to read out, and you get one type of behavior. We discussed about this yesterday. You increase the amplitude, you get another behavior. Well, if you trained it at a certain amplitude, you've also introduced in the system correlations of a certain length scale that is compatible with that amplitude, okay? And the bigger the training amplitude, the bigger the correlations that you've introduced into it, okay? Now, if you now subsequently reduce the amplitude, meaning you're not really undoing the correlations of the length scale that you've already set up with the training, okay? Some of it persists, maybe not all of it. However, one would assume if you increase the readout amplitude beyond the training, you need to build up now, you know, bigger correlations than you had initially put in, which probably will take a lot more effort and, you know, than costing on, you know, a system where correlations are there, but you're utilizing, you know, a length scale that is smaller than what you've put in. So this probably ties in with this asymmetry, you know, in these, you know, when you're below the training amplitude, you get a certain kind of, whereas if you're above it, you basically have to build up on top new correlations, basically.
Okay, so I want to see if I can summarize this in one or two lines. So, you know, depinning does, as Tom said, there are these local relaxations below the threshold.
Right, and they will have a typical length scale.
They have a length scale,
which
right?
depends on, you know, how far you are from the threshold, or, you know, depends on...
Right. And so that's going to depend on the amplitude. And then should I just sort of, you know, to jump to the punchline, can I just draw a dotted line to a spectrum of length scales and time scales, or is it kind of more...
Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
Oh, okay, so let me do that.
But also this might say that, to go back to the, you know, the number, in terms of back to the question of the number, what you have to do to get n memories, you know, you need to have, if you have a system, you pick your system size as being finite, then if you only have so many weight scales within your system, right, then you can only have so many sort of places to store bits, right? And so in order to store more memories, you may also need to have a larger system
Ah, okay.
In order to fit enough patches across your system.
Okay, so as another feature, I'm going to put then role of system size.
Yeah, so system size effects may actually affect how many records you can store, I think. If those are connected, if.
Okay, I want to move on, but are there any other thoughts about systems we're leaving out or?
Can I just ask one thing, which has, at one point I thought I understood it, and now I realize I don't understand. I mean, you were talking about depinning here. Another thing that we've heard a lot about was plastic deformation. And now I'm getting confused between when is depinning, when is plastic deformation.
I think that they're connected in that, you know, if you do enough plastic deformation, if you drive a system enough, these localized rearrangements start to become correlated over larger and larger scales, and they span the system at some point. And around that time, you know, I think it's a matter of debate what exactly, you know, where exactly you draw the line, but somewhere around there is yielding. Right, what you would call yielding, where you transition to something that is dominated by plasticity. So it's not so much the depinning itself that is interesting. As we said, depinning itself on a system-spanning scale corresponds to erasure. But what's interesting is below that threshold, you get these localized relaxations, and these localized relaxations are how driving changes the system. And so I think that the features of those systems, of those relaxations, that the scale of them depends on, and perhaps time scales as well, depend on how hard you're driving the system, is a route to form memories of a specific amplitude, or maybe even multiple amplitudes. And that's kind of where so it's not so much depinning as the physics behind depinning that gives these systems memory behaviors. Karen.
Yeah, and maybe it's even more general, because you have the depinning, but you can also have sort of these plastic models, like for example, the randomizing model is not a depinning model per se, but it sort of has the same types of features, so maybe it's a bigger class of systems.
So I'll put a twiddle here.
Basically, you're drawing, basically what Muirton was saying, you're drawing on the fact that there's a critical point to get your multiple, like a non-equilibrium critical point. It could be the depinning point, it could be some other critical point with a diverging length scale that you use to give these multiple length scales.
Okay, so something that you would not strictly call depinning can still have this feature. And it can still have something akin to this feature.
Yeah, typically a correlation length that grows as you're approaching this threshold.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's say depending like.
Yeah.
You know, we'll just call it some form of, you know, this would be called probably dynamic criticality, right?
There you go.
Dynamic criticality, yeah. And you know, depending is just one of these kind of dynamical systems that mimic critical phenomena that we know from equilibrium stat mech.
Okay, that helps me a lot.
Yeah, so it's more that a dynamical system exhibits kind of, you know, phase transition-like phenomena, although it's not an equilibrium, you know, stat mech system. Which means you have a transition and some growing correlation length that tends to diverge at the distance.
So by dynamical criticality, do you mean non-equilibrium phase transition?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to
understand
what that meant.
Yeah, it's but even maybe in the absence of temperature, right? I mean, where sort of, you know, something else than the temperature, you know, takes the role of a control parameter.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like the driving force, your shear or so,
right.
And you drive it to a transition. You know, and then this transition into the yield is kind of like a phase transition. The system goes in one phase below the yielding transition, above the yielding transition, it's another phase. That's kind of the analogy.
Okay, so I see that it is 11:30. And I want to steer us back to another aspect of features of systems that form memories, and one that we didn't discuss at all yesterday, and that is friction. So, Karen, do you want me to put up your slide?
Yeah,
what do you
want
to? Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And then I have notes.
Okay.
Are we okay staying for
and
longer?
It's 11:30, and Sid hasn't cut me off, so I'm saying that we're doing this. Okay. Right. Okay, friction. Good.
Okay, so this is why I sent Nathan in an email. Okay, so we know two things. So one.
Oh, whoops, I didn't even edit it.
You didn't even edit it. It's literally like, you know, like Nathan. So one, we know frictional contacts encode the history, right? Two, we know that many force networks are possible for any single particle configuration, the boundary loads, and hopefully this plays. I don't know if I haven't shown you this movie. This is an example of many, many different force configurations for a given particle configuration. So we know that both of these things. This doesn't apply to friction.
This has been done in simulation.
This is where we got the idea for almost from simulation. So this is the force network ensemble that Jaap was familiar with, Brian Tighe, and various people have worked on for a while.
So what's happening between frames?
All right, so what's happening between folks?
Oh, microphone.
Oh, yeah, microphone.
They're going to come for
they're
us.
They're going to come running for
yeah.
us, right.
Did we get way up in time? All right, so what this is actually a fake movie. So these are a box on a flat air table, so they're gently floating on an air cushion, so they don't have friction with the base. They do have friction with each other, although I don't, this would be true even if there weren't friction with each other. We open up, I think it's the top wall in this case, slightly. We erase the force chains, and then we put the wall back. And because there are asperities and because the world is real, but we get some configuration here. In simulations, this is true as well, however. So although it's happening here because of the real world, it happens in simulation world as well, that there are many, many possible force configurations for any given set of boundary conditions. And one way to think about this is that if you imagined force balance on this particle, and this is Brian Tighe's work, you could rearrange the forces between those contacts, and it would still be in force and torque balance, right? And so you can imagine a random walk through force configuration space, which is what his work has been about, generating lots and lots of different configurations. So if you could imagine enumerating all the set of particle configurations, adding forces gives you a much larger set, and then adding friction gives you an even larger set still, because now you have two parameters to set at each point. Okay. So let's see, how do I get back to the top one? There you go. Okay. So these are the two things that I've been thinking about. And then, all right, so now we imagine doing, you know, Nathan's experiment, but now with frictional particles, and I can imagine one of two things being true. So one is that the first effect dominates, okay? And that because you actually have this friction, which has a particular direction, you've actually stabilized that memory in some way, okay? And
step back a little bit. So you said, and I agree, that even if you didn't have friction, you have the possibility of many different force networks giving you mechanical
right.
stability. So and therefore, I can imagine that even if I had a frictionless system,
this still matters.
There could be mystery dependence to the force.
I think so.
Is that true?
I think maybe. Right. But even if that were true, then adding friction gives you
more
history. Whatever more. Like, or just from an entropy standpoint, there's information theory standpoint, there are now more possible configurations. And that's the second one, which is that, so this is true either friction or frictionless, but number two dominating means that because there are more possible configurations for the frictional case than for the frictionless case, from an information theory standpoint, so one is that it's a lot harder to find one of these special reversible states that we've been finding about because there's a lot more possibilities that might be harder to find. And so it might be harder to train and read out a memory
what do you mean there's two dominates? What do you mean with that?
Number two, the first two items. So which of these effects, you know, or they both could be true, right? And that was, and that, or maybe they're both true. That it could be that they might be harder to find the good memories because there's more configurations, but once you found them, they might actually be better memories. And there's one more thing, is that because you have more configurations, you actually now have more bits, again, in an information sense, and so you might actually be easier to store multiple memories, right? Because you actually have more bits. But these are all, this is all completely hand waving. So one of the things that we saw in Bob's experiments was, if you saw them, was that he would shear it and come back. And when I look at those movies, the force chains do sort of come back, right? I mean, how well they come back, I don't think anyone's done a D2-min type thing on that to see if they came back well or poorly. But they do sort of come back when you watch the movie.
But he had a movie where he kind of removed all the affine kind of transformations, and then it looked like the sort of the brighter change essentially remained as they are. So you know, mm-hmm. just studying.
But the small ones not
the
so
smaller
much.
Ones were flickering on and off. Right. You know, but you know, there was a big picture, you know, the sort of the fat stuff remained as it was, and then you had some little kind of dangling things here and there.
But you know, that's probably also true if you took, you know, I mean, this is what the whole idea about the D2-min is that, you know, the D2-min has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. It hasn't disappeared, right? So there's some amount of leftover force fluctuating-y. So as long as you get rid of most of these fluctuations, maybe it's, you know, you're safe, right?
I'm just a little confused. If I look at that movie, I saw those force chains fluctuating. What was it that you're saying is the memory?
Yeah, I wanted to ask that too.
Because no one's done the experiment, I don't think. But okay, let me do an analogy then. So if we do Nathan before he stores his memory, right? So he's training. Before he's read out his memory, he's been training his memory. He's going like this, right? And these patches get reversible, and this gets reversible, and now he's D2-min has dropped, and he's now well trained. Okay, I think in Bob's movie, he did cheery stuff. We saw that the force chains were starting to come back.
So I'm just during the shear, like contacts are broken and then remade.
Remade, right? And so I think that part of Bob's experiment looks a lot like Nathan's experiment. It's just that, and we saw that it sort of get trained into this state where it looks like the force chains are coming back. So it's not picking any force network. It's picking sort of a particular one that it now likes. But now the memory's been trained, but I don't think anyone has read it out.
Okay, but so I'm on the same page. But so if I looked at that movie, what you would say is the memory is the way in which the bright spots were the same from time to time.
So it's all of Nathan's variables plus an added field on top of that.
All of those particles were in the same position. That was the point of this.
Right.
And then it was the bright spots, which is the forces on that set of things.
Right.
And am I right in saying that what the memory then is that those bright spots look the same from one place?
And I don't think these experiments have been done. This is all thought experiments, that if you then shifted to a different amplitude, right, then you would be erasing those force chains and they wouldn't come back anymore. And then you have to ask the question, can you do things like Nathan did and read out when read out that this was the strain at which that set of force chains had been trained?
And tree, right.
So I think that would be the memory if there were a memory, that would be the memory. But what's fascinating to me is that there are these two now, there's two sort of simultaneous fields, right? One is the position field that's getting trained, and one is the force field that's getting trained. It's not clear to me that those transitions need to happen at the same point, right? That you've trained one, you've automatically trained the other. And I mean, and we brought up the Gardner stuff already once. It's not, I have tried to do experiments, but not yet succeeded at distinguishing that just in the compression. In this case that I just showed you, we're trying to do that and look to see if the cage breaking of the particles happens at the same place that I don't even know what the cage breaking of forces, what would that even be? The force breaking, the network breaking. I don't know what that, I don't even have a name for it.
I mean,
Right, so those, do those even happen at the same place in general?
One thing that is clear to me is that, like, to me, I mean, I really like what you said yesterday, that friction is sort of the original hysteresis. And one thing that seems really clear is that it's also like the enemy of perfect reversibility.
You're always
going to
lose.
Anytime you're building a machine to position something exactly, you just put loads and loads of grease in there. It's the first step, right? And so if you want things to come back exactly to where they were,
it could never happen
because of all those little microscopic disparities or whatever. Yeah.
But we stand from. That it's not doing a terrible job of finding a force network reversible. It's at least can do it somewhat, right? And that's something that, and that might be a function. This is where I think the Gardner ideas come in, is that we probably see, without being able to quantify it. I want to go to a page. There we go. Without being able to quantify it, and we know this is the experiment that hasn't worked yet, is that if we open this too far, we of course get some rearrangement, right, of the particles, right? And so there's a different place where we can, if we open it just far enough, we can get rearrangements of the forces without getting rearrangements of the particles, right? And so I think these things are somewhat decoupled from each other, that these two fields might not, you might be able to have a separate thing going on with each one. And this isn't a memory that I've put there.
Sorry, I'm confused. Isn't this movie showing you that you cannot train force
change? Right, because like, we weren't trying to train it. This is a movie taken for a completely different purpose.
You can imagine that this is the result, the positions of the particles are the result of the shearing.
Right, and this says that we were unable to train it. So this is the sort of the opposite of what we would want. Like, this is what we would not want if we wanted to train a memory.
Why isn't it, it looks like the things are pretty well fixed in here, that I see the same things over and over again. Okay. So why isn't that a memory?
Okay, so it's a memory of the positions. It's not a memory of the forces.
But the blue thing too. I mean, there's some fluctuations around it, but they're still pretty much. I see the big blue things are still the.
Well, yes, actually, that's the purpose of this experiment. So this is a this is a mini version of the real experiment.
This is really lasting 26 seconds, right?
No, it's not. This is actually lasting about 6 hours. It's a thousand cycles.
It's not that you've shown us a small loop over and over again. This is really real time.
I don't know, 100 configurations out of 1,000.
Yep. Right. So it's not loading.
So we're cyclically loading it, and we're looking at what the. Yeah. So what we're doing in this experiment is looking at what the fluctuations. And this is exactly right. This one seems really popular. This one seems unpopular. Right. There are features that are definitely reproducible, and we're classifying the particles by whether they are reliably on a chain, unreliably on a chain, reliably not on a chain. Right. So the purpose of this experiment wasn't to train a memory. It's just that I'm thinking about it now that I've been here, thinking about this in a memory context.
But you don't despite. Go ahead, please.
No, I'd like to just summarize a little bit and then raise a new related but new question. So basically, Karen, what you're saying is, in addition to the positions of the particles as degrees of freedom in a system with or without friction, as I said, but you know, let's stick to the friction case. I have forces at each of the contacts, which also count as additional degrees of freedom that can be varied, even with the global constraint of mechanical equilibrium. So if you were to sort of subject this system to some kind of memory-forming protocol.
To be determined.
Right. Do you sort of converge onto not only specific positions, but also specific forces?
Right, or do you have more places to hide memories, and so you can do an even better job?
Right. So now, the question I want to raise, I guess, which we haven't really talked enough about, which is interesting, is in either case, that is, whether we worry about only positions or with positions and forces, because what we're doing in these kind of situations is not to sort of encode very specifically chosen memories, but you're doing something to the system that's sort of taking the system to some state which we don't don't always know how to characterize. It would be interesting to sort of think of ways by which we can actually measure and talk about the information content of these structures, which I think we had a little bit of discussion in the conference with Dov's talk. Right. Sort of what are the different ways of characterizing how these kind of trained systems have lost the entropy of information content that the original ensemble had?
Well, and Zorana,
that's interesting.
So when Zorana said, how did you make the system already trained to memorize the positions? Actually, this is, so when we start our experiments, we don't use the first several frames because there is a warm-up period that we sort of like, oh, that's not what we want, so we toss it out. But in fact, that's actually precisely the interesting part in this context. But for us, for this project, it was the part that we tossed. But there was in some sense a training to get it into this configuration. You know, that guy might have been out there beforehand. But we haven't shared this, we only compressed it. So I think, and it seems like of the protocols that Mui wrote down, the compression is the boring one for a particulate system, and shear is the interesting one.
Not necessarily?
Yeah, well, I love compression.
Compression's a hell of a lot easier.
I mean, there's obviously a hierarchy between these two, right? I mean, you cannot see the same force chains while you're changing the particles around. Mm-hmm. Whereas you can sort of, keeping the particles there, you can see different force chains. So right. One of them is clearly slaved onto the other.
Right. Right.
So, sorry. You said, what did Doug say? He characterized the very thing you're asking about. How much, what is this fraction of trapped states versus the trapped fraction of all states that you started from?
Right.
What did he say?
Well, I mean, so he was, no, I mean, Dov talked about how to calculate the information density of different structures.
Yeah, okay.
He didn't particularly talk about what happens when you do something that's like encoding a memory. But this is something that one can, and we've started to look at to some extent. You will find, I think at one level this is sort of easy to do, and some of it has been done, which is look at the information density. And you'll find that if you train a system, it'll change. But then what? I mean, so how do you think about it?
I think what's remarkable is that in this picture somehow, or at least a higher resolution version of this picture, mm-hmm. is encoded stellar trajectories that are reasonably closed. There's a set of trajectories associated with this configuration under the driving that Perrin's been performing.
Right. Under each cycle.
We'll come back.
So we don't see the same, so we don't see the same configuration come back, but we do see that certain particles show up on
are
the configuration
now
of the forces.
Of the forces. Right.
Okay. And I will say that so we actually do experiments on two different system sizes. This one I think is 32 particles, and we can last about 1,000 cycles on this before some particle manages to rearrange that we didn't want to. When we do 1,000 particle systems, we only last less than 100 cycles usually, before we get a cage breaking event that ruins our system. Right, and so there are depths to this idea that systems, I mean, so this is a very strong dependence on system size in this as well.
Why shouldn't I, you know, in some sense, when I was seeing this thing and I was focusing on the particle configurations and I had these flickering things going around, I was thinking, oh, this is kind of the noise that you kind of need, you know, the force changes rearranging. This is kind of the noise that would be a perfect candidate for
stabilizing the memory.
For stabilizing multiple memories, you know.
It's irrelevant in and of itself, but it's
some
only
form of, you know, what other people, maybe it's a form of mechanical noise, you know, which is just coming from this additional many degrees of freedom internally in which you can lay out these force chains on the same configuration. But then maybe it is just too periodic to really But on the other hand, you probably, once in a while, if it sort of throws a wrench into your evolution, maybe this is all you need. I mean, this is kind of, as you said, you last 400 cycles, boom, something happens. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's due to the forces, of course, we don't know. Maybe it's something else. I mean.
Yes, the reason they break is that some force chain got nicely, spanning, and it went pop.
Okay, so it's tied to the force chain.
Right, so it is tied to the force chain.
So, there's something happening maybe on a much, much sort of slower scale, but enough to sort of effectively, perturbing you from time on time, not maybe every, maybe every 100 cycles for this right. thing. And that might just what you need in order to sort of, it is slow, right? So.
That's true, and this maybe
slow,
is a good separation of time
scales. So it gives you a slow
scales.
Relaxation time scale, which you kind of need in order to maintain maybe a second memory, like this evaporation in the spell model, which is a very slow kind of process, and therefore you can have this long transit where you see both memories.
Right, so that's that's actually falling in number two, that because you have this extra bath of configurations, this actually is providing the noise bath that you need.
I like that friction destroys perfect reversibility, but in doing so, can make the memory.
Serves a good purpose.
Yeah. It worked for you, actually, in a way.
So why do you not want page-breaking events?
Because the question we were trying to study, we wanted many copies of the same experiment. And so, in fact, the advantage of the 32-particle one is we can put them all back where they started and just start over again.
By hand.
Because we can put all 32 particles back where we wanted them.
Does touching them change their friction properties? You don't use your fingers, do you? You push them around with the stick?
These things are handled by people all the time.
Because you have a little oil on the edge.
There is oil all over a lab. There's air currents in the lab. There are people walking by in the lab. This is not a clean experiment. This is
not under glass, this lab.
Nothing like that.
That's what makes it an experiment.
There's a lot of stuff going on. The humidity from day to day is different. lots of things change. Yeah, but with the 32 particle system, we can literally just put them back if we want to. Right. So they have some advantages. But we wanted many realizations of the same particle configuration, and so that's why we used small systems. Yeah. We also used large ones, but they were annoying.
just one thing about the entropy stuff. And so we looked a little bit at that for the sheer things. And yes, you can see there's entropy for the single memory at t equals zero. Clearly, you're pushing particles apart to a certain distance, and that distance then remained over and over again. And so but what is not at all clear was if you now try to have multiple memories, and so you have some noise in the system, so you have this difference, then maybe there's something there, but not anything obvious that we could pick up.
But how to actually calculate the information content. Like, what's the maximum amount of information that you can store for, name a system, I think is not, it's not obvious to me at all.
So one, I think, problem with, looking at this information content is you're looking at a very large number of degrees of freedom system. And presumably, the sort of changes to the information content that you're affecting is small, so you're looking for a drop in an ocean, even if that drop is in fact there, and maybe that's not the best way to do it, so maybe one has to think of better ways of measuring that, but it's, since you are talking about encoding information of some sort, it is interesting to ask what is a good way to look for that information. I think maybe, I'd like, since it's sort of coming up as a new topic, maybe we can go back and think for a day. And
tomorrow's discussion is information theory? Tomorrow's information theory?
there's a way that kind of leads, if I think about the Bellows origami and these others.
But even
some similar, like Lev systems or so, where you had some kind of elastic description, which though in the end, when you sort of integrated out the elastic degrees of freedom, it reduced into some effective spin model. which was capturing maybe the plastic transition, you know, and the elastics. So then for that spin model, you can certainly, you know, they are probably measuring some information content also, because it's a lot fewer degrees of freedom, and so would be kind of, would make sense. And it's probably those spin configurations that are the memory itself anyway. So you can, you know, maybe there's some hope in these things.
Okay.
So I
there's one more, there's still one more thing you wanted to talk about after this.
There are lots more things, but I think I should show maybe my
list
of questions, because this may be stuff that we want, this may be a discussion that we want to continue tomorrow, and we certainly just hit on something about sort of the search and meaning of, search for and meaning of steady states that we may wish to talk about tomorrow as well. This is, oh, what's, okay, here
yes.
Right, so I think that we addressed some parts of this first question, which is great, and found a role. I like the idea that it's not depinning physics specifically, but it's some sort of dynamical criticality that often gives you those features, that hierarchy that you need to have interesting history dependence. So we talked about friction, and that led in interesting directions. I think one thing that really should be addressed, if we can, tomorrow, is unlearning, is erasure. One thing that Zorana pointed out to me yesterday is that all of the readout processes that we've been talking about, of how you tell whether something has a memory or not, are destructive, right? And so, that is, you may not destroy the memory completely, but you at least degrade it a little bit in the process. And is there some sort of information theoretic rule that says why that should be true generally? Maybe not always true, but true a lot.
But in your system, just a non-random extension, if you just did X-ray scattering of that, you would see G of R and you would,
okay.
You would see that. And that's
so that's the question is, can you read out a memory just by having detailed access to microstructure? So let's bring that up, but it sounds like we just had an interesting idea on that. And then the other thing is multiple memories, and not just what can you do multiple memories, because I think we touched on that a little bit in our discussion of this hierarchy of timescales. But also, what is the capacity for multiple memories? And are there other considerations besides just a hierarchy of timescales that you need in order to think about putting in and reading out multiple memories? And that is, I think that's pretty much it. And then I just want to mention also things that we just haven't touched on at all practically, which are other types of memories that we've had some exposure to in this program, and we should keep looking for ways that we can tie those in with these more physical systems, or more materials-based memories versus, I mean, this is still physical, but it's different kind in terms of the training approach.
So I would just like to point out, Robin, even for materials that have a specified trajectory of motion.
Right.
Sometimes there's more than one physical state available, and so you have degenerate elastic ground states, and the system may have a complex trajectory, maybe not quite as complex as 1,000 disks and amorphous configuration.
But
you can have degeneracy in mechanical ground states.
Right, about that. So is, I mean, these are materials that can be changed by deformation as well. Is there some sort of training that these could go through to prefer one ground state over another?
Jonathan, because of his interest in the materials that are still the defects are moving around, and nobody's tried, as far as I know. So all the types of ways that strain was used to impact microstructure was usually just to get rid of all the defects. Stretch it out, make it defect-free, it'll be a simple actuator. But it may be that those systems, like other types of amorphous systems, are subject to training. What I was going to say, though, is that even if you think something simple, like a swelling disk where you can strain the circumference, it can't expand, so it has a choice, it can pop up or it can pop down. If you make a matrix of those, which, for instance, Ryan Hayward could do experimentally, then you could ask the question, if one of them pops up, does it mean that the neighbors will pop down? I mean, all of a sudden, it's like an Ising model. It might be ferromagnet, it might be anti-ferromagnet, but it's elastic instead of magnetic.
So Rolf Solarius has a granular experiment that's like that, where they can, it's a nearly double-layer granular system, and it can either be all on the left side or the right side, because they can't pass each other. So he has a granular version of that.
You have to show me the picture. I can't see it from the words.
We'll find it.
So, I think one thing, just as a final word, like one thing that I think that I hope we got out of the discussion today about what are common features of memories, and then from yesterday about how could you access the material's memory behavior, is that we are thinking of new systems that haven't been looked at much at this point. That might display these interesting behaviors and ways to test that. So that's a great way to end. Okay.
Okay, so let's thank Nathan, Leticia, and Karen for all of this.